It's my pleasure to introduce Eric Weiner. Eric was a longtime foreign correspondent for National Public Radio, writes a regular column for BBC Travel, and his work also appears in the Los Angeles Times, the Washington Post, as well as NPR's Morning Edition. He's written New York Times bestsellers, The Geography of Bliss and Man Seeks God, and he is here to discuss his latest book, The Geography of Genius. This is interesting stuff, so let's meet him. Hey, Eric, welcome to the show.
Hi, Steve. Happy to be here.
You know, I understand that some of your neighbors have recognized your specialness when you were younger, especially when you dropped a water balloon from 15 floors and broke a neighbor's windshield, and they said, hey, way to go, Einstein.
Yeah, they were they were impressed with my scientific curiosity.
I see.
Yeah. You know, just because you write a book with genius in the title, Steve, does not mean that you are a genius.
So I think you state pretty categorically that you're not a genius, but
right.
You've got some good reason to hope that perhaps someone in your family younger than you may be a genius. What is the definition of genius?
Well, I'll tell you what, it's not. I really think it's not just raw IQ score, being a smarty pants or a know-it-all. It really is creative genius. It's making a conceptual leap. You know, German philosopher Schopenhauer said, and I love this quote, talent hits the target no one else can hit. Genius hits the target no one else can see. That kind of leap. And I should add that once you hit this target no one else can see, other people have to see it then. Otherwise, you're just that nut job in the corner hitting invisible targets. So at some point, your genius needs to be recognized in order to really become genius. It's a social verdict in that sense.
We have these people in history who are notable for hitting a target that no one sees. I mean, Einstein comes to mind for certain.
Right.
And, you know, Mozart as well, and so many others that we can look back. And yet, your philosophy or thinking is that genius is really not a person, it's more of a place. Am I correct on that?
It's both. I don't want to take anything away from a Mozart or a Beethoven or an Einstein, but to look at them in isolation is almost like a shooting star in the sky, that they just come along randomly. And when they do, we look up at the night sky and we go, oh, wow. I wonder when the next one will come along. It doesn't work that way. I mean, a better analogy than the shooting star would be the garden, you know, and the genius is the fruit or vegetable that's grown in the garden. And yeah, you need a good seed, you need that genetics, and you need the water and the hard work, but ultimately you need the right soil, the right place, and the right time to make that genius blossom.
So more nurture than nature.
Yes. You do need the seed, as I said. You need a little bit of nature, but you need a certain kind of nurture, and it's more than just, when you hear the word nurture, you tend to think of mother with her daughter or son or a family and that kind of small-scale nurturing of the unit of the family, and that's important in a way, but I think what's more important is the bigger milieu, you know, that's going on around that person, the place and time they're born into. And I really think that gets short shrift. I think we have largely ignored that, partly because we just are so in love with this myth of the lone genius, you know, against all odds and doing his or her thing without any regard to the world out there. And it doesn't work that way.
Well, you mentioned myths. You know, you write in your book that the myths are that, first of all, a genius is born.
And right.
Genius is made through hard work, and geniuses are kind of grown in the soil somehow. How do you dispel the fact that, you know, genius is not born per se?
Well, I think a good way to look at this actually is with a slightly controversial subject, a question that always comes up. You know, people say, Eric, why are there so few women geniuses in your book? And it's true. And the reason is because there are so few women geniuses historically. Now, why is that? Well, if you subscribe to the genetic theory, you would have to conclude, and I am not concluding, but you would have to conclude that women don't have the genetic wherewithal to become geniuses. And that's why we've seen so few. Or that if you believe genius is all about hard work, you'd have to conclude that they don't work hard. Not true. So what is it? It's the soil. which has been largely controlled by white men for most of history, and that have not given women, A, the opportunity to pursue genius pursuits, and B, even if they manage to, against the odds, don't give them the recognition. I think that's sort of the best evidence that it's not genetic.
Well, the book is The Geography of Genius, with the emphasis here on the word geography, so it's place that matters. And you say, we rarely see one genius here, one genius there, but instead we see genius clusters. And I think this talks to the idea that it's a lot about the cultural environment that one finds themselves in. And in history, women really didn't get a chance to participate as well in the cultural environment as much as men did. Let's look at some of these places you talked about. You know, you've traveled all over the world to Greece, Italy, Scotland, China, Silicon Valley to investigate how genius takes root. Let's go back in time. You mentioned Florence as a good example.
Mm-hmm. It is. I mean, you know, when you think of, well, the Renaissance man, obviously you think of Leonardo da Vinci, original Renaissance man, at least in the Western mind. And, you know, he also came out of a system, a creative ecology, I think is actually the best term, one that I like quite a lot. And that was a creative ecology that was really bolstered through money. And I subtitled that chapter, Genius is Expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And I realize that's a little bit provocative because we don't tend to think of genius as having anything to do with money, right? They don't need money. They don't work for money. But that's not true. You know, Florence benefited mightily from the generous and very smart patronage of one family in particular, the Medici, who didn't just throw their money around haphazardly. They got art, they understood art, and they had a really keen eye for talent, for spotting invisible talent, if you will, or talent not yet visible, I'd put it that way. And they, more than, frankly, Leonardo or Michelangelo, help explain the greatness that was Florence.
Mm-hmm. You also speak about Athens. Before the golden age of Athens, you said nobody would have bet on them. They were not particularly special. They were weaker than Sparta, but they had certain characteristics which showed up later on. What were those characteristics in Athens?
Well, they drank a lot. That's part of it. No, seriously.
Yeah.
They,
okay.
Recent research shows, Steve, that a little bit of alcohol will make you more creative. Although a lot of alcohol will make you fall down.
Yeah.
And they drank it a certain way. You know, they cut their wine. They watered it down 5 parts water to 2 parts wine,
mm-hmm.
perhaps knowing that it's more conducive to creative thinking. And they did this drinking in very social settings. Mm-hmm. And this is a common thread. They called it a symposium, literally drinking together in ancient Greek. And there's almost always in these places a venue for people to voice ideas freely, unbridled way. So they had that. And they did a lot of walking, which is very conducive to creative thinking. In fact, they did their philosophizing while walking. But I really, if I were to point to one thing that explains Athenian greatness, I would say it's their port of Piraeus, which they used to sail the entire region and to mooch. The Athenians were great moochers. This is one of the dirty little secrets of the place, is not all that much was invented there, not as much as we think. A lot was perfected there, though. And Plato said that what the Greeks borrow from foreigners, they perfect. Now, the foreigners might have considered it stealing, but still, that is important. And they had that one trait that psychologists identify as the single most important trait for a creative person, or I think a creative place, and that is openness to experience, openness to the other. And they had what we would characterize in today's terms as an fairly open or liberal immigration policy.
You mentioned taking others' ideas and improving upon them. You also speak about Edinburgh, Scotland, which was really a very out-of-the-way place. It was dirty, it was poor, but they were able to take other ideas and really improve upon them, a better plow, a better steam engine. What was it about Edinburgh, Scotland that brought them into this culture of genius?
Well, first of all, like many of these places, it was not an easy place. It wasn't paradise. It was, as you say, small, kind of dirty and smelly, to be honest, even by the standards of the day, and isolated, perched up on the edge of the world. They just lost their independence to England. So you look at it again, you think they don't have a lot going for them, but they had something to push against. And that's important. And I really do think that creativity is always a response to a challenge. We don't always rise to that challenge, but some places and some people do, and the Scots did, and they really had, and I think still have, a very practical strain of genius that they really believe in, as you say, improvability, whether it's a plow or a steam engine or ideas. And they sort of married the worlds of ideas and practical innovation. And it really came to the forefront in medicine. It was the place for medical research for a while, actually. And some of the founding fathers of this country studied at the medical school in Edinburgh and then returned and signed the Declaration of Independence, for instance, a man named Benjamin Rush. So it was a place where ideas were only of interest if they were practical.
I want to mention that my guest is Eric Weiner, and his book is The Geography of Genius. You mentioned the role of growing up in difficulties. Many of these geniuses you mentioned grew up dyslexic, grew up without a father, or let's say they had some challenge in their lives. And it's a kind of the opposite of perhaps today's society where, you know, employers, for instance, are trying to spur creativity through, you know, giving a lot of perks in their business and so on. You mentioned that, you know, Athens was burnt to the ground before they rebuilt into their golden age. What were some of the other places that kind of went into chaos first before coming out?
Chaos and trauma, really. Florence is a good example. You know, just a couple of generations before the blossoming of the Renaissance around 1400, you know, the city was decimated by the Black Death, the bubonic plague. A third of the population was wiped out. It was horrible, no doubt about it. But, you know, it also shook things up, shook up the social order and created more fluidity, which is really essential for a creative place, fluidity. And that's almost always the case. There's a stirring of the pot. Something is going on. And I saw that time and again in the places I visited.
Chaos seems to be a necessary ingredient.
Yeah, and not anarchy. They're not exactly the same. But a certain stirring of the pot, a certain fluidity to life. You know, there was a neuroscientist actually named Walter Freeman, who studied the brains of rabbits and would hook them up to EEG machines and then introduce these rabbits to odors, some they were familiar with, others they were not familiar with. And he noticed that whenever the rabbits were introduced to an unfamiliar odor, their brains would enter a chaotic state, what Freeman called an I don't know state. And I think that's crucially important. You really need to enter that state of, you can call it chaos or ignorance or I don't know, but something that breaks the previous pattern. And there's a kind of intermediate period where the old pattern is being dissolved, but a new pattern is not yet formed. And call that chaos. That's what it is. And that's essential.
How does that theory explain the burgeoning of Silicon Valley in the United States? We see that as a cluster of genius right now.
Yeah. That's a good question. I've been thinking about this. There was no Black Death, or, you know, the Persians did not burn Silicon Valley to the ground.
And that's a good thing.
But there was the sinking of the Titanic in 1912, which in a strange way, I think, helped lead to the, at least the seeds of Silicon Valley being planted too. Within a year after the sinking of the Titanic, Congress required all ships to carry ship-to-shore radios. Radios were a new technology at the day. And one of the places where there was a huge interest in this new technology was Palo Alto, California, in what we now call Silicon Valley. And that requirement helped the industry a lot, and it helped a few small firms, one called the Federal Telegraph Company in Palo Alto, grow. And it really instilled this sense of tinkering. Amateur radio took off in what's now Silicon Valley. And that idea of the amateur having as much of a right as anyone to play with these new toys, that lasts to this day. So it wasn't a catastrophe on scale of the plague, but it was the sinking of the Titanic. And it was simply, to be honest, the fact that they were so far away from the East Coast establishment, from the money and the elites and the power, that they were freed up to think freely.
Last question. Do you think more education creates more geniuses?
No, I don't. In fact, statistically, if you have a PhD, you're less likely to become a genius than if you do have one. And at first, we might find that surprising because, again, one definition of genius is just someone really smart with a lot of degrees. But if you think about it for a second, it makes sense that the PhD, particularly in today's university system, is for the most part, not always, but for the most part, really required to learn more and more about less and less to specialize. And the creative genius, by definition, is making surprising and useful connections between different fields or different domains. And I think the sort of specialization you see at not all universities, but many universities, actually discourages that kind of interdisciplinary thinking that's essential for creativity.
Maybe it has also something to do with Dereschowitz's book, The Excellent Sheep, which perhaps we can discuss at another time. My guest, Eric Weiner, the author of The Geography of Genius. Eric, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Steve. It's been a pleasure.